everyone, and welcome to another episode of Working Within Season 3. I'm not excited today. I feel like divine. I feel like I'm just catching all the opportunities as they come to me, and I'm very, very grateful to have our guest today, Christian Pendarvis, on the podcast episode. We met through a mutual friend, shout out to Jeff Livingston again. And Christian is someone who is like very central to the disruption happening in the fashion industry. And that is because of her role with Savage X Fenty. I told her many times before that we started recording this episode that I would need to have a moment about that. And I've had many moments with her about it. This is someone who's seen each fashion show probably like 10 times at least. Someone who every time someone comes to their home makes them watch the fashion shows as well in order. And I just super appreciate everything that Savage X kind of stands for. And I appreciate what it's done to the industry, especially when we think about different versions of beauty and what we think is sexy and what and how people can express themselves through clothing. So I think it'll be, I know we'll have a great conversation with Christian talking about kind of her path to her position now and just a lot of the cool things she's been able to do with her career. So that's just a mini intro from me. But Christian, could you please introduce yourself to the audience. Please share your big three placements. That's really important. And anything else you want to share before we dive in?
Absolutely. Well, I need more people like you that are encouraging people to watch all of our fashion shows. So if I could clone you, get you to replicate yourself, a little Star Trek humor there, that would be fantastic. But no, I'm super excited to be here. So I am Christian Pendarvis. I am the co-president of Savage X Fenty, which is Rihanna's lingerie brand. Doesn't get old ever saying that, that my boss is Rihanna. Pretty cool. Gives me a little credibility with my children. And my big three, because I am also into astrology, I am an Aries sun sign. I am a Virgo moon sign, and I am Scorpio rising. So I'll let you guys kind of, you know, try to marinate a little bit on that. So, but I'm super happy to be here. Thanks again to Jeff Livingston for connecting the two of us.
Yes. And you know, listeners, before, like, we have a little sideline already. When I was meeting Christian, I had no idea, I think until like our second conversation at least, that she was into astrology. And I was like very hesitant to tell her I was a Scorpio because, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff. And then when I found out she was a Scorpio rising, I was like, thank you. So thank you for that. There's so much misinformation. Anyway, well, Christian, and I know we've talked, you have like a long history in retail and industries where, you know, appearance and fashion is important. Before we even hit those career notes that I know are really significant that you've had, growing up, like, what was your experience with fashion? Were you a fashion person? Were you a fashion kid? Like, how have you morphed into this person now?
Yeah, I mean, I have always loved fashion and clothes, right? And beauty and hair and all of those probably stereotypical things, you know, being a teenage girl. But I also grew up in the Deep South, right? So South Carolina, that's another thing Jeff Livingston and I share in common. And, you know, I grew up at a time where you really dress, right? That's part of what we learned in our culture. There were moments where you got dressed up to go to church, you know, you got dressed up with my grandmother, who was very, very into fashion, like very, very into fashion. She, you know, had Stuart Weitzman shoes before like anybody really knew who Stuart Weitzman was. And she had like hundreds of pairs of Stuart Weitzman shoes. And I was the only person who could actually wear the same size shoe as her. So I was super lucky that I inherited a lot of her shoes, but she would get dressed up to go to the mall, right? So she was very much that person of your appearance matters, right? And it matters in certain circumstances. For her, it was more than just fashion for frivolous reasons, right? And I think honestly, part of that was, you know, my family grew up in the segregated South. And there was this sort of expectation for how you need to hold yourself and present yourself in mixed company, right? So some of this around clothing and fashion and appearance really stems from that as a foundation. So that was sort of who I was growing up. You know, it was the pantyhose to church. It was, you know, if you, you know, you had to have your nails polished, and it was, everything was sort of wrapped up in that. And I carried that forward, right, into college. So like, I was the kid that didn't really wear jeans, right? I always was more dressed than that. I had a whole collection of hats. You could probably hear stories from people of me wearing hats around campus. I was not going to be, you know, in the sweatshirt going to class. I always had makeup on, and I always had a red lip, and all of those things. And so I was super fortunate, I would say, to find fashion as a career, you know, because I was economics major, you know, at Harvard. And I think like everyone else, when I was graduating, I did the round of investment banking interviews. I did a few consulting interviews, because that's what you do if you have an economics degree from Harvard. And I remember sitting, maybe it was a Goldman Sachs interview, I can't remember, but or JP Morgan, thinking, oh my God, I'm in this interview, you know, in New York. If this is what I do for a living, I'm going to shoot myself. This is not what I wanted to do for a living. I knew I wanted to be in business, and I got exposure to fashion merchandising and buying. There were a couple of retailers that came on campus, and I did a couple of those interviews. I think one was with Saks, and the other one may have been with like Liz Claiborne or someone like that. But the more I learned that, hey, I can actually combine something that I'm super interested in, fashion, with business and form a career. So I feel super fortunate. You know, my first job out of college was as an assistant buyer with Neiman Marcus. So I found this space for me really, really early on.
Yeah. That's heartwarming. And also right now live, and listeners, this is true, I'm realizing so many things that we have in common, Christiane. I'm going to go in chronological order because I want to follow up on that first job and like just see like how your career has panned out from that. But going back to what you said about your childhood and dressing and like your mother and grandmother, like that being something that was just like woven into how you were raised. My parents also grew up in the Deep South in Alabama. I did not, military brat, I can't claim any place, but that's where my grandparents are. Like that's where, you know, my roots are. Clothing was also very important in my family because of the exact same reason, because of like humble beginnings, but also like this is a place where we are moving away from this place in Alabama, and like no one needs to know kind of like that's where we're from, and that just being like a really real tension that was alive in my life as we moved around the world, like we can establish ourselves. And so appearance became very important in my family too, and especially in the military. That's also a whole other thing we can talk about, how rigid that is and why my parents hate my nose ring. But appearance is really, really important. And I think, you know, especially for Black families, as you mentioned, when segregated environments were new still, that's very important because there were so many things that we couldn't announce and stand, but what we're wearing carried a very important message. So I just wanted to kind of underscore that reality of the Black family, or what it can be. There's of course not one reality of a Black family.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I do think it was one of those two of, there were so many things out of their control, right? There were so many things that they just couldn't have influence or sway over, but how you looked and what you wore, that was within your control, right? So it was sort of, I think this opportunity to say, where can I have power? And I can have power over my appearance. And for, you know, such a long period of time, people couldn't even have power over that, right? So it was significant in that sense, I think as well. And I was definitely one of those kids where, you know, if you took my earlier point, if you were going shopping at the nice department store, right, you had to look a certain way. You know, the first, I think, time I flew on an airplane, you know, you dressed up to get on an airplane. You didn't, you know, it was no like sweatpants or leggings or, you know, you just didn't do that, right? You, in those settings, you took advantage of the opportunity to showcase we were not what people said we were. And that's also part of the narrative.
Yes, it absolutely is. And I'm grateful to my mother now. She had me picking out outfits when I was a little girl. And I'm grateful because I actually like have a fashion sense now. I wouldn't, you know what I mean? And like, I didn't know what she was doing, but she knew what she was doing. And she's very creative. And that's a whole nother story. But it is very empowering to have control and like intention with how you choose to look. I have found it. And I love, it's one of my favorite ways of expressing myself. So, yeah. Also, I love that you used to wear a red lip because I'm kind of getting into red. I've told people, like, I'm weird like that. This is my year of red. It's like I'm wearing red right now. That's why, okay?
Okay. You can never go wrong. Red is one of those colors. It looks good on almost everybody. There's a shade of red, whether it's an orangey, brighter red or a blue red, which drives my husband crazy when I say things like, it's a blue red. He's like, no, it's red. I was like, no, but it has a blue tint to it, so... I know you don't understand color the same way that I understand color, but the red is one of those colors that everybody can find a shade of red that works for them.
Yes. And that is why you're co-president of 7XFenty. Okay, so I want to talk about that, but I want to get there, of course. I want to let the listeners know because part of working within, you know, we've talked about power already, by the way, which I'm so grateful for because women need to talk about power more. That's first. And also you already experiencing so early in your career, something that we talk about this podcast a lot is like listening to yourself and being able to tell like, oh, this is or isn't for me, and trusting that and like changing it and being able to do that again and again. And obviously I don't know your story. I'd love to hear it though, about how you've navigated your careers after that assistant buyer position. You know, I was in a very similar place, in undergrad. I did the investment banking interviews and did all of the consulting interviews. And yeah, I even did banking for a few months and I was like, I cannot do this. Like I know myself and I did it. And just being able to use that information to like recreate my reality, that was really important to me. So like, can you tell me about that first assistant buyer position you mentioned and how it's like brought you to where you are now? And yeah, what happened? Like, what was going on for that time for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was in retrospect a really great place for me to start my career. You know, one was Neiman Marcus is an amazing storied retailer with an amazing history, and I started, you know, on the luxury end, which part of that was about the glamour and the thought of going to shows, which unfortunately I never actually got to go to as an assistant buyer. But and I started in the men's division as well. So I didn't start in women's ready to wear, which is obviously where I think most young women say that's your dream is, you know, become a women's ready to wear buyer. But I say it was great for me for a couple of reasons. You know, one, I started in men's and I did men's tailored clothing, which is, you know, back then this would have been the early 90s. And I was selling suits that were $2,500, which back then was like really a lot of money. Still a lot of money even today for a suit. But back then it was like really, really a lot of money. And so it was one of those things where I really... One of the first principles I learned was how do you build a business for someone who's not you, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not a man. I didn't have the money to spend on suits that expensive, even if I were. So I really had to learn about my customer, who they were, and then how do I select product that's going to appeal to them in order to drive the business, which I think, you know, when you start in an area that you have a personal affinity for, it's sometimes easier to apply your taste and your perspectives to that. So I think in retrospect, starting in men's was just great to build that foundation of being very customer centric, because that's how you unlock business potential, right? Is really learning your customer. I think the other thing for me that I loved about that role, right, was this was pre-casual Friday, right? Men were still wearing suits to work every single day. And I worked in a division that was headed by this this gentleman named Daryl Osborne, who is iconic in the men's clothing industry. He's unfortunately since deceased, but iconic. When I say iconic, I mean like iconic. You know, he had been in the business probably for even like 30 years at that point in time. knew all the designers, right, by the first name, and traveled to New York and Milan and Paris and all the shows. And he was from Texas, ironically enough, but literally looked like Winston Churchill and spoke with like this sort of fake British accent, or slight British accent. And, you know, we were in men's clothing, men's tailor clothing. So he was a throwback of like the utmost. He wore a three-piece suit every day. Right. So he always had a vest on. He carried a pocket watch. He did not wear a wristwatch. He always had a flower in his lapel. He always had a pocket square, right, in his jacket. He always had a hat on, right? So a straw hat in the summer, a bowler in the wintertime. And he literally, and I'm not making this up, wrote with a calligraphy pen and an inkwell, right? He did not use a fountain pen, you know, no ballpoint, everything. And this was back in the day, you know, before everything was done electronically. So if we wanted purchase orders to be approved, I had to go to his office to get him to sign them. And he literally would take out his pen and dip it in the ink and then wrote everything in calligraphy. I am not making this up. And he was one of many characters at Neiman's at that point in time. And I say that was important for me because while I didn't, you know, sort of experience all of the glamour that working, you know, in the fashion industry for a luxury department store and going to New York, I did experience the characters that the industry has known for having. It's always been, or probably not always, but at least in my lifetime, always been more open for LGBTQ people. You've been able to define yourself how you wanted to. There was always, I think, this broader acceptance of just people being themselves and being different and doing different, right? And I appreciated that. And I also appreciated the theatrical nature of it, right? He was a theatrical person. Like he would, for our division, the men's division, I was only one of two women in the entire division. The other woman, a Black woman, was our purchase order coordinator. And she had literally been with the business for like 20 years. And then everybody else were male. He would send out holiday cards to all of our vendors, and he'd make us dress up in formal attire, come to the downtown store, which is where the buying offices were above the downtown store. And we'd take our holiday cards in front of like the decorations in the morning in the downtown store. It was, everything was very theatrical with him because he understood retail is about show, right? Retail. And that's honestly some of the things that I hearken back to what we're doing with Savage today is retail is not just transactional, right? Particularly not now. Physical retail has to be significantly more than just transactional, right? Because you can go on your phone and I can get Amazon to deliver it to me in 2 hours, depending on where you live, right? So there's got to be a reason, like literally in 2 hours, or Instacart, and it can be here in 30 minutes, right? There's got to be a reason for customers to come back into a physical store. And so this idea of experience, of theater, of transforming and transporting people into something that feels different and exciting, that's what retail has to harken back to. And that's some of what I've learned, like in those early days at Neiman's and working for Mr. Osborne, who I had to call Mr. Osborne. I did not call him by his first name. We all had to call him Mr. Osborne. You know, those were back in the day. So it was a very formative, I think, initial foray. But, you know, it took a while for me to realize that ultimately retail is what I wanted to do. So I went back and got my MBA. And I got introduced to brand management. So I did an internship with Procter & Gamble between my first and second year, and then got a full-time offer and went back to P&G, which was a great company, an amazing company, great place to learn about brand building and marketing and advertising. But I realized then, you know, after 2 years that I really missed retail, and retail was in my blood. And I remember when I was leaving Neiman's to go back to graduate school, Mr. Osborne said that to me. He was like, "Christian, retail is either in your blood or it's not, and you'll figure that out." And I did. I got the opportunity to figure that out.
I was just touching my heart because I just like when, so first of all, let me just backtrack a million times here. Memoirs are my favorite style book. And so when I have people on this show who are just like explaining to me in like really well putting together a lot of experiences in their life that have put them in the place they are now. I think that's so valuable. As a younger girl, I was very eager to like figure out life. I still am, obviously. And like, I'd just be like, tell me the answer. Like, I just want to know now. Very like bossy, but not bossy because like I was just a self-assured little girl. But so I just really value you being able to just tie like all the connections together for us. Yeah, retail is in your blood. So I wish he was here to see that because it's really awesome. Again, to fangirl about Savage X Fenty, I think it is so beautiful what that brand is doing in the world. And as you mentioned, like retail being about show and it being about performance and being a really welcoming space for expression, that makes it ultimately more important that like all forms of expression at least are celebrated, because there are so many different types of people that are here that maybe felt unwelcome from fashion or from the image of beauty that I think Savage X Fenty is not trying to uphold. So let me not speak on your brand, but like that is my experience of it. And I'm just like super grateful that it is happening because, growing up, I grew up in Europe for a part of my life. You know, I was a Black girl in very white environments for a lot of my life. And a lot of what I saw drove like how I felt like I needed to express myself. So straight hair, graphic tees, and like things that weren't really me, and like being afraid of tattoo, being afraid of piercings, and just being able, like, I think it's just a perfect time in the world for us all to just like kind of release those like preconceived notions of what we think beauty is, and what we think expression is, and what we think fashion should be, to like redefine that. I think it's a perfect moment for Savage X to be opening stores and like doing all the cool things. So
absolutely it is. I mean, I think it's an amazing time in fashion, because as much as I think the industry has been welcome to certain parts of community, as I indicated, LGBTQ for a long time, it hasn't always been welcoming of Black folks. And I love the industry. And in some ways, if I have to compare it to others, I will say I found it to be more of a meritocracy. Not 100%, but more, right? Because, you know, in retail, we get a report card every single day, right? And now as a direct-to-consumer retailer, I can go online and tell you what my sales were through, you know, 30 minutes ago, and know how that's comparing to, you know, what I did the day before. So, and that's one of the things that I love about being in the industry is like the customer tells you every single day, are they voting for you? Are they voting against you, right? And so if you're jazzed by that, and you want to try to figure out, you know, what can I do about it, which is the other thing, I can then put something up later this afternoon on my site and change, you know, what the experience looks like. So that was honestly, when I did my brief stint at Procter, that was one of the things that I realized and learned, that I just missed the immediacy of retail, of that customer voting directly, right? Because at Procter, I worked on, you know, like a packaging change. I was on Bounce Dryer Sheets, was one of my brands. And it took like 9 months to change the font on the outside of the packaging. That was like 9 months to change the font on the outside of the packaging. Like, come on, guys, that's crazy. So like, to Mr. Osborne's credit, retail was in my blood, and I made a move back into retail. And it was interesting because, you know, I had done 2 years of business school, 2 years at P&G. And, you know, I started my career at Neiman's. And so I was like, okay, I'll go back into department store retailing. And so I reached out to the people at Neiman's, and I talked to the people at Saks about jobs. And, you know, everybody said, well, you're going to have to come back as like an assistant again. And I was like, wait, what? I just literally did 2 years of an MBA program, and I've been working for, you know, one of the best brand CPG companies in the world. What are you talking about? I have to come back. And they're like, well, you know, you make too much money, and you've been out of retail for 4 years. And so there was like a bit of limited thinking in terms of what I had just gone through and done and how that could translate. And so that's where I actually got exposed to specialty retailing, which, for those who don't know what that is, it's, you know, it's retailers who develop their own brands and their own lines, right? So I started with Gap Inc., with the Banana Republic division specifically. And that was, again, a whole nother like, awakening moment for me, because I learned about the role of a merchant, which is a little bit different than a buyer. you know, as a buyer, we would go and I'd go see, we'd see Brioni's line or Zegna's line, and we'd buy product for the most part that they had developed, you know, for the entire market. You might be able to get some exclusive product that you might work with them a little bit on. And there was a little bit of private label that was in the department that I was in at Neiman's, but not a lot. In specialty retailing, you're developing a collection, right? So you're working in partnership with a design team to decide, like, what do I want to carry from the ground up? And you're working to fit those garments, right? So how exactly are they going to fit? What's the aesthetic for our brand, right? So it was, it made sense that when I started interviewing, they actually appreciated that I understood brands and brand equity, right? And brand aesthetic. They appreciated that from my experience at Procter. And so it was a nice combination of what I had done at Procter and then also my love of apparel and retailing, you know, moving into that environment. So I essentially, for most of my career, have been in specialty sort of ever since. And I love, you know, the little bit of art and science that is creating an assortment, because it really is that. You've got the scientific part of, you know, what are the major categories of product or types of product that are going to drive the business? But then there's always the art of what's trending right now, what's relevant to my customer. And so that's one of the unique things I think about being, you know, on the specialty side of the house. So I started at Banana. I started again in men's, moved over eventually into women's, and spent, what, 3 or 4 years at Gap before I made a detour for personal reasons to move back to Texas, which is where my boyfriend at the time, who is now my husband, was living. And so we had been long distance for a couple of years. And it was like, hey, either you need to come here or I need to go there. And we ended up with me going to back to Texas. And I tried to get, you know, job back in some of the retailers there, apparel retailers, but the opportunity that presented itself for me was like a complete and total detour, but was going to go work for Radio Shack. Right, which completely and totally different, not obviously in apparel, but still in retail. And I had a friend who was at Procter & Gamble with me who had just recently joined them as a VP of marketing. He said, listen, we're hiring for the first time outside of the company, because Radio Shack had been a solely promote from within company for a long time. So most of the people in the senior leadership team actually had started as sales associates in the stores and worked their way up. And he's like, and we're looking for someone who understands fashion, right, to run what they would consider their kind of fashion product category. So I ran the toy business. I ran music, which would have been back then cassette players like Sony Walkmans for the most part. And this new thing that was called an MP3 player, like that was like brand new technology back then, that was just coming out. I did like keyboards and karaoke machines and health and wellness line for them. So it was like their more fashion oriented assortment, which meant, you know, that they deliver product once a year, like one new product once a year. Very different, obviously, than my background in fashion, but it was, you know, different than the vast majority of their business, which the product had been there for, you know, 5 or 7 years, even some of the products. So it was just a very different experience. Yeah. It was, again, another life lesson, all these moments along the way. Part of the reason I did it was for personal reasons and relocating back to Texas, but it was also a big jump in title for me. So it was the first time I had gotten a vice president title. I was running, you know, a small kind of division, and that was enticing, right? You know, jumping that kind of level and getting a full team. I think, I mean, I probably had like 10, 12 people on my team or something like that. And so that was a big deal for me. And so I was like, yep, absolutely. Let's do this. Let's take this job. And part of what Radio Shack, which obviously doesn't even exist really today, was doing then was trying to evolve the brand, right? This is back when Circuit City, which also doesn't exist anymore, was trending better. Best Buy was a big category killer, you know, in consumer electronics. And Radio Shack, which had been another story retailer, had been around for a long time, had lost market share, had lost relevancy, and was trying to figure out how to reinvent itself. And so I was like, okay, cool. This is an interesting sort of challenge to be a part of. And, you know, what I came to realize over the course of, I think I was only there, maybe even 18 months, not quite 2 years, was it really mattered to me to believe in the brand and the brand proposition. And I remember I go into some of the Radio Shack stores and I think, oh my God, this is just such a terrible experience. Like, I don't want to go in here. And the reason that most people went in there, this was back before the big cell phone carriers had their own stores. So people went to go get a cell phone at Radio Shack, right? Because they had Sprint and whoever Verizon was before they were actually Verizon. I've forgotten who it was at this point in time. But people would go to Radio Shack to get a cell phone and to get batteries. Those are the two reasons why anybody went to a Radio Shack. And they did need to reinvent themselves. But there were so many things that the company was proud of its heritage, and, you know, sort of rightfully so, that I just said, you know what, I don't love this experience for the customer. I have a hard time believing that this is sort of the right approach for this business long term. And I really struggled working there. There were parts of it I loved. I absolutely loved working on toys. Like, that's as fun as it sounds like it is. It's probably the most fun I've ever had running a business. Is just, you're working on toys, right? And that business at Radio Shack was primarily radio controlled and remote control cars. And they were doing, and we were doing super cool stuff, right? So like the new Fast and Furious movie would come out and we'd work in partnership with, you know, Universal and do remote control car versions of all the cars that were going to be in the movies. So you were working on cool product development. You were working with the automobile manufacturers to make sure, you know, you really replicated the vehicle the right way. And then you were also, you know, just working on cool stuff that was coming out. And so getting ahead of that. So that was truly a fun, exciting kind of part of the job. But I just fundamentally didn't believe in the brand, and didn't believe, you know, my vision for what needed to happen to transform that brand wasn't aligned with, you know, what the leadership at the time believed in. And so that was sort of like another little nugget along the way on the journey for me. You can't just work anywhere. For you, it really does matter. I know for some people, it's like it's a job and I collect a paycheck and I do what's required and you can sort of divorce that. For me, it was too much caught up in my own identity for me to be proud to say, you know, that I worked at Radio Shack. So I ended up leaving, didn't have a job, and I quit. Right? I was like, I can't do this anymore. And I ended up taking some time off. And then I got back into sort of my passion and my love, which was more on the apparel side. And I went to go work for Victoria's Secret. And I had to take a step back, right? So I've been a VP, but only for like 18 months. And I was talking to Victoria's Secret. They're like, yeah, you're not a VP level here. You're going to have to come back in as a director, right? Which was like, okay, that's great. But I got into intimate apparel for the first time, moved to Columbus to go work for VS, which was, again, another kind of great experience. I learned how much I do like this category in intimate apparel. You know, and VS at the time was still the dominant player. I mean, still is the dominant player in the space, but like really dominant at that time. It was still the heyday of the fashion shows, which was like, the best employee retention tool is, you know, sending your employees to the fashion show and getting to experience the glamour, you know, of the VS fashion show back in the day. And so I ended up coming in as a director. I got promoted to VP about a year later. I was running one of the sub brands. It was the best job title that I had in my entire career. So I was running the sub brand called Very Sexy. And so my business card literally said the Very Sexy Vice President, which I was like, it's perfect. I will never, ever have a title that's quite that good for the rest of my career. And I learned.
I'm putting that in the episode. Yeah.
And I learned a great deal, you know, about the industry. And intimates is an interesting one. It's not, it doesn't have the same glamour, right, that ready-to-wear has. But it's this hybrid almost of a more CPG type business or brand with a little bit of fashion. There's much more, I'd say, sort of strategic direction around how you can build out your assortment. There's a longer term strategy to, I think, how you think about product. It's less fashion cycle and sort of trend oriented. than the apparel side. And then there's this interesting sort of emotional component of intimate apparel. You know, apparel for me personally has always been highly emotional and relevant, because as we talked about, but not for everyone. You know, some people are like, I don't care. I just, whatever I put on doesn't really matter to me. But intimates, I think for women, is different, right? It's, if you're wearing the right intimate apparel, one, it can make you just look better under your clothes, regardless of what you're wearing, right? Under your clothes. But it also has a lot to do with how confident and comfortable you sort of feel in your own skin. And so there's this emotional component and significance, I think, that intimate apparel plays, particularly in women's lives, different, you know, sometimes than the apparel. And I didn't really appreciate that until I started working at that brand. So I was there for, you know, 4.5 years. I left to go work for a competitor. I went to go work for Aerie, which was still a very young brand at that time. Aerie was born out of selling underwear in American Eagle stores. And I think they had, you know, just embarked upon opening standalone Aerie stores. And so when I came on board, it was the first time they were bringing someone who really had deep expertise in intimate apparel to be the chief merchant there. And so it was fun helping kind of craft that brand and being able to build it and opening more freestanding stores. It was unfortunate it happened right during the financial crisis. So I joined in, I want to say like October of 2008, right when the market completely and totally crashed. So, you know, it was a challenging time to be in the industry, but it was also fun to be a part of building something that was still relatively new, that was an upstart, that was really trying to challenge the juggernaut that was Victoria's Secret. So spent quite a bit of time, you know, within intimates between those two. And then I made a move to go back to San Francisco, to go back to Gap. I rejoined the company and was running the men's business for Old Navy. So going back to men's was the first time I'd done kind of value. So I've done luxury, I've done intimates, I've done hard lines, I've done women's. And this was the first time that I was like squarely in the value space with Old Navy. And that's one thing I'd say for my career. You know, I fundamentally believe if you know how to run a good business, you can run a good business regardless of what the business is. You may have more or less affinity for certain types of products than others, but the principles still apply of understanding your customer, understanding your competition, thinking about how you want to position your brand versus everyone else, building out your strategy. You know, all of those fundamentals still apply across all the businesses. So I was running the men's business for maybe about a year and a half, almost 2 years. I had my kids. I had twins back in 2013. And I took, you know, an extended maternity leave. So I think I was out like five months, maybe almost 6 months. And they backfilled my job while I was gone on mat leave. So when I came back into the business, you know, the job I had previously was no longer there. And there actually wasn't a job open in the business running anything at that moment in time. So they just kind of like parked me doing some like, you know, projects, strategy work. And I ended up, good fortune now, landing on this project that the CEO at the time was really championing. And it was about how do you change how Gap operates, right? As a global omni-channel retailer. At the time, every sort of market channel combination at Gap and the brands was a separate. So I ran the men's business for Old Navy, but I really ran the stores business in the US for Old Navy. I developed a global product line that serviced all markets and all channels. But in terms of what I was accountable for, I was really accountable for the US stores business, which was the lion's share of the business. But I had a counterpart that then ran the US online. The people who ran Canada were separate. And at that time, Old Navy was moving into Asia. So there was a separate international division, right? So all these divisions were separate and everybody would buy product separately, right? So I might be going after, you know, a certain strategy for the US stores. The US online business could be going after something completely different, right? Yeah. Customer doesn't think about them as being different, but the approaches across the different channels could be different. So that was inefficient, right? And I think the CEO at the time recognized that that was inefficient, and he created a project. So you guys have to relook at this. You have to relook at, you know, how these businesses are operating. So I was sort of like an internal consultant, you know, looking at how things were operating, studying the market, studying what other retailers were doing. And it was fun. Like, it was fun to kind of step out of the business, no longer be on the treadmill, the rat race. I wasn't looking at numbers every single day, right, to see how I had done the day before. And it was the first time I think I had really been out and had an opportunity to assess what was going on in the market. And so that was sort of the bug for me that started this journey into direct to consumer. I was working with a lot of people that had worked on the direct to consumer business, the people on the tech side, right? So data scientists and analysts, I was working with product management teams. I was working with developers and engineers really for the first time as we were thinking about the model of how Gap needed to operate, and then what were also the systems and tools that they needed to sort of transform how the company was operating. And so it was during that time frame that I realized, like, hey, I really do want to get into direct to consumer. Like, there's this whole thing that's happening and I have zero experience in that, and I feel like it's something that I should learn about, right? When I was running the men's business, it was a $1 billion business at Old Navy. I think it was like the fourth or fifth largest business in the entire company. And I didn't even know Gap had data scientists, right? And people who could do predictive analytics and those types of things. Like, it's just, it was so bifurcated and separated that I just didn't have that exposure. And so I ended up leaving Gap to go work for a startup in San Francisco called Mintit, which you guys have probably received either holiday cards or wedding invitations from Mintit. And I had zero direct to consumer experience. So obviously they couldn't bring me in running the business. So I came in an operational role. But it was one of those things where I felt like I really needed to learn from the ground up. And I needed to learn it from a digitally native brand, like the ins and outs. And I remember sitting in my first like Monday sales meeting, and they were talking about SEO and SEM and the shopping funnel and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, what language are they speaking? Is this like a retail business? I just don't, yeah. It was so foreign to me. It was like Greek. I didn't understand any of what they were talking about. But I did 2 years there, eventually took over merchandising for them as well. You know, I became more ingrained in the business, but it was a great opportunity for me to really learn the ins and outs of this business, and then have moved back into apparel. And that ultimately is what led me to my role with Savage, which is an interesting culmination of a lot of what I've done in terms of merchandising and product development, time in intimates, and then time in the direct-to-consumer space. All of those things kind of came together in the role that I currently have with Savage.
Destined divine.
Didn't know that at the time, but it tells a good story now, right? In retrospect, it has actually built to that moment. Not that I could have predicted that this is where it could have built to, but it definitely, all those building blocks were there leading up for me for this moment.
Yeah. And you like listening to yourself, you putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, like especially at Mintit. I can imagine. I've been in rooms where there's just like so much industry jargon. And you're like, okay, I know you all know what's happening, but like, please let me know. Like, I don't know what that means. And so just being comfortable doing that and knowing and having enough like of the, I don't know, like inner fortitude to just know that that's something you wanted to learn about and it's something you're passionate about and you're willing to do that for the sake of the businesses that you like to build. Like, things like that are how we get to that later like image of ourselves and that we could never predict because we were just following like a series of like those uncomfortable experiences and just being able to like be comfortable with new, because I know, at least in my experience or what I've observed, it can be really easy to get comfortable and to stay comfortable. And like from you detailing kind of like the way you approach your career, it does not seem like that really ever truly happened. Like maybe you spent like a chunk of time at some place, but like, no, you were building.
Yeah. And sometimes, listen, honestly, forced to build, right? If things didn't feel right and you just felt like you needed to step into something new, you know, so it wasn't always as, I think, as much forethought around it. There were just these moments where, you know, you could do this or you could do this and you're like, okay, I'm gonna go do this. Right. So I think I want to make sure that people recognize that you'll have those opportunities. Right. And part of what I sort of have come to realize is, I don't want to say you can make a bad choice. You can't make a bad choice. You can make bad choices sometimes. The worst thing about making a bad choice is if you don't learn from it, right? And like my Radio Shack experience, right? I know why I did that, right? Part of it was I had moved and needed to be in Dallas. I was, you know, lured by the title. I probably wasn't really ready for that level at that point in time, but I learned through that experience, right? And the worst thing is if you make a bad decision and the situation doesn't end up how you want it to end up, but you don't learn anything from it, then it's really been a waste. It's never a waste if you don't learn from it, right? If you learn something, there's a nugget that's going to influence how you're going to respond and behave in the future differently, then it wasn't a waste, right? So, but that's on you to make sure that you sort of hindsight what happened, why it worked or didn't work, what drove your decision making, what, you know, that maybe was off, so that you don't make the same decision again the next time. That's the power and the value. And along the way, I've learned tremendously. And I know, like, I can sit here 100% confident and say, I am significantly better in this job today because of all those things that I've learned, right? When I was at Aerie, in that chief merchant role, I was great when it came to managing sort of my universe and my team. I wasn't great managing up. And part of it was I ended up working directly for the CEO of the company, and that had not been the original intention. The person I was going to be reporting into ended up leaving the company before I started. And so I was thrust into a situation where this guy supported me coming on board, but he didn't actually hire me, right? And it was a financial crisis. The big mothership of that business, which was American Eagle, was suffering, you know, with, as everybody else was, in the recession. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go over here and do my little thing on Aerie. And we're so small, nobody cares. But I didn't also manage up. So I didn't really keep him abreast of what we were doing. And so that caused conflict. Like later on, when he wants to dig in and it's like, well, why did you do this? And I didn't know you guys were doing this and X, Y, and Z. And so I learned through that experience. Like, as great as I felt like things were with my team and how we were growing the business and what we were accomplishing, you know, the people above me didn't have that same perspective because they didn't have the same insight because I hadn't involved them in it. So again, I think every place along the journey, there have been bits and pieces that I have taken and learned. And so as I sit here today in the role that I'm in, I'm infinitely more capable and been more successful because of all of those moments. But you have to take the time to say, what happened here? What could I have done differently to drive a different end result? And then what am I going to do differently in the future, right? Which is a principle that you sort of learn about managing a retail business. You learn that over and over again. I have taken that muscle and said, I have to apply that to my own personal journey and my own career so that as I step into new opportunities, I feel like I'm the best version of myself to take on that new opportunity.
And it sounds like accountability, like personal accountability has been really important because you're like, okay, if I didn't do it here, I want to do it here. And that's really important for like self-awareness. That's important for leadership. That's just really important. So thank you for like bringing us there. I have one more question for you, Christian.
Absolutely.
And I want listeners to know this first as context. When I first talked to Christian, I explained to her I'm really creative. She did not describe herself as creative. I wonder if any other listener would agree with that after hearing your story about building so many things, right? Because building is creation. It didn't exist before. You had to create it. It's not just painting. It's not just drawing. You know, that's creative energy. And so with your role now as co-president of Sapiens Fenty, as chief design and merchandising officer, what are you most excited about building now? Like what are you most proud of? What brings you that joy and fulfillment now in your role?
Honestly, it's been seeing how customers respond in our retail stores. So we started as a direct-to-consumer brand. January of this year, we started opening our first brick and mortar stores. So we have 5 that are open right now. And we just announced that we're opening another 6 stores over the course of this year.
Congrats.
Yes, which it's been incredible. You know, when we go to the store openings, particularly when we went to our first opening, which was Las Vegas, I was just really not prepared for how much of an impact in people's lives the brand is having. So we opened a fashion show mall in Las Vegas. There were probably 50 to 60 people in line before we opened up. Ray, I mean, just thrilled. And as soon as we opened the door, you know, there's cheering and screaming and everybody's walking in the store with their phone and videotaping. And it was such a party atmosphere. People were so excited about coming to our store opening. And that's been kind of the formula that's been repeated for the vast majority. There's always a line of people. People are just excited to be in the space and to see it and to support our brand. And what I'm always sort of moved by is what you acknowledged earlier and talked about our brand, that we recognize people who've not been seen and showcased in this industry. And that matters a lot to people. You know, we've literally had people in our store in tears, you know, talking about, I'm a big girl or I'm curvy. And when they see, you know, our mannequins are done off of real people's bodies, right? And they're not all, you know, a perfect size 4. So we're showing real bodies in our forms. We're showing real bodies in our marketing imagery. And we're saying, you know, you are sexy and you are beautiful and you are a badass and you deserve to be showcased just like anyone else, right? Whether you're, you know, have a sleeve tattoo, a nose ring, vitiligo, like whatever it is, the full complement, you know, of what diversity means. We have a little person brand ambassador. We have people who are, you know, amputees. We, like, you name it. And we kind of are showcasing, you know, all these distinct and different people and saying you too can be as sexy and provocative and sensual as you want. Like, it's yours to define for yourself. And that really matters to people. It really does matter for them to feel like they are seen and celebrated. And so that's the thing for me that I'm the most excited about, is that we're just changing that conversation and letting people know that they're as worthy. There's no ideal standard that people have to measure up to. And you should feel good about yourself because you are you on your own terms. And so, you know, growing the business is great. You know, all these other things that we're doing are fantastic. But that is the moment for me. I think that I recognize that's the impact, regardless of ultimately how big Savage gets to be, you know, regardless of whether we're a public company one day or whether we're not, like, regardless of all of those things, just the fact that we are pushing that conversation within the industry and we're telling customers, you don't have to put up with the alternative. And I think that's driving people to say and demand from other companies, I expect the same from you. To me, if we do nothing else but that, right, we will have had a monumental impact as a brand.
You already have. I'm just so grateful. Oh, Christiane, drop the mic, literally. I just want to, like, rethank you for your time today. I want to rethank you for the work you're putting in at Savage Fenty, doing exactly that. The impact is real. That's why I'm such a big fan, because it's real. You don't see yourself in the media. You don't see, and then Savage X comes and revolutionizes how people are doing that, how we're celebrating bodies, sexiness, being different. It's beautiful to see. And, like, I can't wait to see what other things it inspired. And in fact, like, I feel like it just aligns with a lot of what we're trying to do on the show. So that's why it's ultimately even, like, more awesome that you're here talking to us. So thank you for that. I don't have anything else for you. I just want to know, like, where can listeners look to learn more about you, kind of follow along, things you post? Like, where is the best place for that?
Ooh, that's a good question. I am really bad about that. Probably LinkedIn is the place that I'm most consistently putting anything up. But if you try to follow me on Instagram, you'll be like, I'm really sad and disappointed because she's super boring and she maybe posts something once every 2 months. So everybody has their opportunities. Social media, not my strong suit on my personal side. So I'd say maybe LinkedIn. You can find more on LinkedIn. I did do a talks at Goldman Sachs, which you can search on YouTube for that if you just search my name. And that's actually a really good piece because it's more about kind of me personally and some background about my family. But between LinkedIn probably is the safest bet.
Okay, cool.
another opportunity.
Yes. Hey, you're building. Okay. So I will make sure that folks can access those in the episode description. Christian, it's been awesome to hear about your journey. It's been awesome to hear about how you like approach the world, how you've been building. I'm building. I want to build. I want to learn from you. So I'll keep bothering you. But no, thank you so much for your time today. And listeners, I hope you're feeling inspired as well. Because it's just awesome to have her on the show. So.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.